I'd like to introduce Dean Hartley, who is our board member and officer of Sunset Heights Association. And he's also a stand-up comic. So I don't think this is going to be a very funny presentation, but he should be prepared to handle the situation as a moderator. Dean, take it away.
Thank you. Thank you, Frank. Thank you for that kind introduction. So thanks to Frank. I don't need to tell you my name. I am a board member of SHARP, and I'm going to start by thanking the Golden Gate Heights Neighborhood Association and Stop Crime San Francisco and SHARP for co-sponsoring this event. And I thank you all for being here in the audience. We'll try to make it very interesting for you. And thank you to Frank Noto for recruiting a couple of presenters tonight who I think are going to have some very interesting things to share with us. Okay. I am going to talk a little bit about the format of tonight's meeting. We do have two presenters. I'm going to let them speak to us free form, one at a time, for as long as they need. They have a few things that they'd like to share with us about themselves and about their backgrounds and so on. And at that point, I will be introducing subjects for them to discuss on our behalf. And once again, thank you to the audience, because we've received some of your questions, and those are going to serve as the impetus for some of the subjects I'm going to bring up. Please let me introduce our guests first. Our first guest is Ms. Ginny Barton. And Ginny has a fascinating background. She is a former substance addict and a multiple convicted and punished felon. And reading her biography, I would call Ginny the human basketball, because she certainly landed hard, but boy, did she rebound. Eventually, she put her life together, engaged in scholarship with honors at the University of Washington. She is a mother of three, and now she advocates for more effective social safety nets for the people who are exposed to harm from these substances. Welcome, Ginny. Our other guest is Mr. Tom Ostley. Mr. Ostley has participated as part of the San Francisco District Attorney's Crime Strategies Unit, or CSU, which sounds like it could be an interesting title for a TV show. This enterprise was a multi-stakeholder collaborative effort to come up with innovative strategies and tactics in order to deal with chronic crime of various sorts, including the crime that's associated with drug sales and drug use. So what we have tonight is people who have deep experience on what we might say are both sides of the subject that interests us. One person who can speak very personally about what the economy, the seductions, the life of drug harm, and another guest who can tell us about what we might call the clean and sober world might come up with effective, humane, and understanding ways of dealing with it. So with that, welcome, Ginny. Welcome, Tom. Ginny, the microphone is yours. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Dean. And I just want to thank you, SHARP members, for inviting me to share my experience. I'm extremely grateful to be partnered up on this panel with Tom, who I have a deep respect for. It's sometimes interesting to me the alignment that him and I have in regards to our perspectives on this topic. My name is Ginny Barton. I'm a recovering addict. I spent 30 years in active addiction. My parents were both addicts. My drugs of choice were heroin, methamphetamine, and cocaine. I had a 30-year history with the criminal justice system. I've been in and out of prison three times, twice with my mother. I was arrested and put in jail numerous times. I have 17 felony convictions and I lost my children to the state. All of this was surrounding my addiction. After I got clean at the age of 40, which I didn't do because I made the choice one day, I was arrested, thankfully, I decided that I wanted to serve others like myself. So I worked in Seattle, first in a reentry program, and then I went to work for the largest nonprofit in Western Washington. I began as an advocate in a Housing First program that implemented harm reduction policies. I then worked in behavioral health as a peer counselor for the same agency, then was promoted to supervise 3 homeless housing case management programs, serving a population of 50 and older, supervising 5 case managers. The drug problem in our nation is out of control. And I think the question and the comments in the beginning of this forum indicated exactly those problems. In my opinion and in my experience, policy has everything to do with those murders. And I would agree with you that the term that is very realistic is murder, because when we make the decision to support the kind of things that are taking place in our streets, we're saying that we really don't care what happens to people. Somewhere we have decided that it's okay to be an addict, to commit crimes, to live on the streets, to sell drugs, to victimize people and make society unsafe for everyone else. The policies that support this are also out of control. There seems to be a disconnect between accepting that a person is an addict and supporting the behaviors that addicts wield on society due to their addiction, as well as addiction to drug sales and money. As if the disease of addiction is synonymous with cancer and the person has no control over what happens to their lives. In one sense, that's a true statement. An addict often loses the option to choose once they put drugs in their body. However, this is a willful act and addiction is able to be arrested. It's our job as a society to remove people that are wielding their addiction all over the community and making their problems everyone else's to deal with, as well as when they're unsafe to themselves, not just the folks in community. When people are a harm to themselves, it's still our responsibility to make sure that we keep those citizens safe. In another sense, the addict is very aware of their behavior, yet compelled to continue to act in these ways in order to get their needs met and stay high. It's society's job to hold people accountable, and we're not doing that anymore for some reason. We look at the harm reduction policies as the solution. What's being solved with these policies and who's writing them? Is it somebody with lived experience? Somebody that's overcome those kind of environments? Harm reduction is the idea of meeting the person where they are, or in other words, helping a person remain suspended in their addiction, which is the literal application of the policy. My question is, how are we actually measuring success? The genetic trait that causes a person to be an addict is not something a person can control, but the effects of a person's drug use is not something to be overlooked or tossed to the side. If we do that, we're consenting to live without law, essentially. Narcotics cause different levels of deviance. For example, when a person uses drugs like meth, cocaine, crack, heroin, and fentanyl, it opens up different levels of awareness and willingness to participate in acts they would not normally do. The average person should be able to identify with this statement when considering the effects of alcohol. Many people that don't identify as substance abusers make the decision to get behind the wheel of a car when they drink, or they participate in other behaviors that they normally wouldn't once they've taken a drink. Drug use is no different and actually lowers inhibitions even more than alcohol in many instances. As a person with lived experience, I'm frustrated that the acceptance policies causing this lack of accountability on our streets are supporting the destruction of human life. It's the job of our system to provide people with the necessary training for independence in our communities. For example, implementing required rehabilitation services when a person is committing crimes due to drug use. There will definitely be a portion of the population that will always have a level of dependency. However, with the implementation of real supportive rehabilitative services, we can reduce system dependency significantly. Much of what we see happening in many major cities today is not a solution. The policies that support street encampments, open-air drug markets cannot be viewed as hope. They're a band-aid on a gaping wound. We can blame the doctors for prescribing, we can blame the tech companies, but the bottom line is we are supporting addiction. We are supporting the abuse many of the people on the streets are being victimized by. We are walking over bodies and we have stopped being concerned with human life. The murders via fentanyl are an example of this. We're also attracting people to the cities that support these policies when we tell the public that we're not addressing these issues. When we refuse to address underlying causes of addiction and hopelessness, we're eliminating people's opportunity to get where I and others like me have gotten. Because laws and policy were in place when I was in my active addiction, it allowed me to be separated from my environment. Eventually, I was able to participate in a drug diversion program. I fought my way out of my circumstances because I gained access to real services teaching me to be accountable. This opportunity does not exist for people in addiction today. As drugs and crimes associated with drugs are decriminalized, programs like drug courts have become pointless. Instead of educating addicts with addiction issues to grow beyond their addiction and stabilizing the community without drugs, we're using these programs to support the dealers that do not have the same dependency issues and leaving addicts on the street to die. Often the dealers in drug court walk out of treatment and continue to sell to the people the drug diversion court programs were meant to serve. This is a huge waste of resources, and the programs have become ineffective. As I made my way out of a life of drug abuse, crime, violence, and destruction, I made the decision to go to school. I did this because the person I was in a relationship with relapsed on drugs, and I became the victim of a drug-induced tirade. When he made the decision in his addiction to commit a crime against me, I knew that he needed two things. He needed to be prosecuted, and he needed help. The system that incarcerated him was not in a position to give him the help that he needed. So I made the decision to participate in the entire court process. He was facing a life sentence for what he did, which I thought was extreme. I advocated for something much different, and after a number of years, what I fought for became a reality. He received a shorter sentence and was required to participate in services that I suggested that the court mandate. He is now free. He has more than 5 years clean, and 2.5 of those years are on the street. During the time he was going to trial, I also supervised 3 case management programs serving the population that I talked about earlier. In each of those settings, I felt like there was more I could be doing, but I was unable to do so due to contracts from the city. I did not believe that I was serving at my highest capacity and knew that to impact change on a massive scale that would actually help people, I would have to go to school and get a degree. The people creating policy for people like me had yet to create solutions that worked. It was imperative for someone like myself to gain access to that arena. And here I am today. Today I'm a graduate of the University of Washington, and I am a Martin Honor Scholar and a Truman Scholar. If I were on drugs today, there would be no way I would be where I am. And that's what we're denying people on the streets. We're denying them the opportunity to actually live and thrive. Many people, like myself, do not have the foundational learning necessary to fall back on in order for them to pull themselves out of these situations. And that's one of the things that we're ignoring. We're calling a lot of these policies compassion, but we're not actually looking at the foundational cracks that exist in these people's lives, because people with lived experience are not participating in the conversation. When a person is an addict, they are compelled to use drugs even if they don't want to, specifically when it comes to opiates, whether it's heroin, fentanyl, or even hydrocodone. I think that what's happening around us in society is being pressed to do something about the problem, and no one knows what to do, so they keep sweeping the problem to the guy on the right. People that actually understand what it takes to solve these issues are not being consulted. That's one of the reasons that I really appreciate Tom, because Tom got a hold of me well over a year ago because he had a deep respect for my experience. And that makes me feel like we're actually moving in the right direction. And so I'm really grateful for him. We're supporting the problem that has exploded all over the nation with a lot of these policies. And I would argue that 100% of the people on the streets are addicts. And the reason that I say that is because when I was a service provider, folks that were economically displaced were the ones that you would see in shelter accessing services. They were not the people that you saw staying in tents. Because what happens when a person chooses to stay on the streets is they are no longer required to adhere to any of the rules inside of any of these service facilities that require them to be abstinent for any period of time. The solution to a lot of these problems are no longer being implemented, and they have everything to do with being separated from the destructive environment, allowing enough time and space for the person to gain some clarity in their life, having an in-depth needs assessment and implemented when in fact they have some clarity that is not drug induced, and then having the appropriate services, having the real true model of harm reduction implemented into their life at that point, which is meeting the person where they're at, seeing where the need and the deficit actually exist in order to implement the services that can help them to become stable and independent so they're no longer taking away from society, they're no longer a burden to the people that they're victimizing, and they're no longer burdening themselves. And many of these people that are in these situations actually have children, but we've forgotten all about the children and we've placed them into a whole nother realm of preparing them to be the next generation of homeless, drug addicted prisoners. However, with the last statement of prisoners, we're not prosecuting anymore. And I think we see a lot of that in San Francisco. And I just want to say to anybody that's listening that I do apologize. I am not a native San Franciscan, but I lived in Seattle for the last 21 years, and Seattle is well on the way of becoming the next San Francisco. I want to read something. I'm in contact with a number of people. My life went crazy viral all over the world because of my story over the last year. And I have a lot of folks that reach out to me who have family members that are impacted by addiction, that are in cities that are supporting a lot of these policies that are not helping people to become their best selves. These policies that are literally supporting the death of the people that are on the streets. There's a woman and her daughter is in active addiction. She is being housed through a program called Housing and Essential Needs through Catholic Community Services. There is no requirement. It's a harm reduction housing first model. There's no expectation for progress. So the woman has asked me how I can help. So I asked her today how her daughter's doing. So she says she refuses long-term treatment. So we just sit back and wait nervously. We sprinkle her days with love, mostly in messages. My boundaries say don't hang out around Kara when she's using meth. She gets scary, wacky, and threatening. I don't want to feel scared or feel shaky. She's a little thing, but when on meth, she becomes someone no one will want to be around. I know she must be so lonely. She has told us that she is lonely. I have told her that drugs are separating us from one another, and more than that, separating her from her children. I have told her it's up to her, and I pray all the time. She's a Christian. In fact, Christian is her middle name. Thank you, Jeannie, for asking about Kara. If you know of any miracles, please fill me in. I just want to say that that is the direction that we're moving in. Parents are losing their children. Children are losing their parents. Spouses are losing their significant others, and brothers and sisters are losing each other because we have made the decision to support these destructive paths that people go down, saying that we're just really sort of supporting their consent. But in most circumstances, when a person is causing harm to themselves or other people, that is when we as a society make the decision to intervene. And for some reason, we're not doing that anymore. When a person is on drugs, that's not the person. They often, similar to myself, I wanted out of my addiction, but I could not stop myself. And it took the system to intervene in my life to actually give me the opportunity to become who I am today. And who I am is very impactful. I've gotten the opportunity to participate in some really necessary conversations to try to push forward a movement so that we can actually help the most vulnerable in our society. So that's what I wanted to share. And I really feel like Tom has a lot of insight into this, not only as a prosecutor, but also as a service provider, because in his work, everything that I've learned about him, his entire focus has been to help grow people beyond the need for services to become their best selves. Thank you so much for letting me share time with you tonight.
Thank you, Jeannie. Tom, the stage is yours.
Wow. Thank you, Jeannie, for the kind words. And thank you, Sharp and Stop Crime SF for having me. I just want to tell you really briefly how I kind of got involved in the service provider sector. And that started when I was in law school. I moved up from Los Angeles to go to Berkeley. When I was there, I did a lot of the clinicals for the East Bay Community Law Center, which was helping people with government benefit issues obtain the benefits that they're entitled to. I helped defend evictions and help people with HIV disease. After graduating, I continued to work at the East Bay Community Law Center as a contract attorney. I also worked for Bay Area Legal Aid, doing the same kind of work, helping people obtain the services that they were entitled. The vast majority of my clients were drug addicted, and I saw those issues. I also was aware of problems they were having with the justice system, particularly with police. So I started a student group that represented citizens that filed complaints against Berkeley and Oakland cops. And I did that work for several years, volunteering, helping people file complaints against law enforcement. And then I opened up my own private practice where I did eviction defense, and then eventually moved back to government work. And that's when I became a prosecutor. So, you know, a lot of the service providers that I had worked with previously were kind of dubious about, you know, me joining the dark side, as they put it. And it was never my intention, you know, to become a prosecutor, to punish drug users. I mean, that never even entered into it. The system, in the ways that I thought the system was broken, I thought it was fixable. I thought that it should be working to help people out of their addiction, to make their lives better. And as Jenny pointed out, you know, their family members, a lot of my clients had children that were also being impacted by drug use, and those things weren't being properly addressed. And I thought that mindset of, you know, not a continuation of the war on drugs where you want to punish drug users, it's to try and stop the behavior. The thought of having animosity toward a drug user, I just never even factored into it. And it seems like there's a misconception that that's what prosecution is, and it's not. There's a lot of services available in the Bay Area. When I was a prosecutor, the way that we kind of addressed these issues was, I don't have the answers. I'm not an expert. I don't know what the defendant needs. But my thought was, the one person who might know would be the defendant. So there was a program called alternative sentencing that existed then that Gascon had created. And the alternative sentencing planner with the defendant, with their attorney, would sit down and talk and say, well, what got you here and what do you need? Do you have children? If so, if we can find you housing, supportive housing with treatment that accepts children, would you take that and be reunited with your kids? So by using that system, we were able to have people that were just as involved actually create their own plans that would start while they were in custody, work all the way through to them being out in sober living, and then to get job training and so on. And so we were able to obtain many success stories like Jenny, but it's a lot of work, and everyone needs to work together on it and kind of have the same plan as far as moving forward. And there's a lot of barriers, and a lot of those barriers are, you know, a misconception that because you're prosecuting someone with drug issues, that you're trying to punish them for having those issues. And it's not. It's trying to help them move past it, and also drawing a line in the sand and saying, you're hurting other people. You can't continue to do that. And saying that that's unacceptable. So that needs to stop. And that can be done while avoiding incarceration and without, you know, harming people. I do want to comment, too, quickly on the issue with fentanyl. Fentanyl has changed the game. When I left the DA's office, I think there was about 60 or 70 drug overdoses. I had seen that they were spiking when I was in the crime strategies unit, and that was one of the Tenderloin narcotics dealing was one of the things that I was starting to work on. And then it just exploded now, where it's 1,300 in the last 2 years. One of the only concern I have about dealing with fentanyl, as the selling of fentanyl is a higher crime and charging manslaughter, is that when people overdose, you want people to call for services. And so the only issue that I would have is if there's a chilling effect, if people are using drugs and someone overdoses and people are worried about being charged with a crime and so they don't call for assistance. Other than that, I have no problem jamming people up. I can also talk to what Jenny said about how the dealers don't use drugs. The vast majority of the dealers that I dealt with had no evidence of any drug problems, but they were being sent to drug court, taking up those services, taking services that drug users need, and then also offering drugs to the people trying to get clean while they're there. So that is just a gigantic boondoggle as far as a waste of resources and also triggering the people that are trying to get clean. So, you know, I think it would be a good time to take questions if anyone has any, but I can say that everything that Jenny spoke to, I saw for the whole, not only the time that I was a prosecutor, but also a legal aid attorney. And it, what she described matches what I saw happening with, you know, hundreds of clients.
Thank you, Tom. Jenny, Tom, psychologists have often said that if we human beings want to succeed at transforming ourselves, improving ourselves, bringing our best selves forward from where they are today, one of the necessary things that we need to put into our lives is structure. And one of the questions that came up is, will rehab treatment programs, and let's just cross out the rehab, let's just say treatment programs, work without law enforcement backup? And I think what that question is referring to is, you know, the incentive effect that the criminal justice system can sometimes provide or at least offer to a person's personal transformation. Could you discuss that a little bit, please?
Do you want me to take it first, Tom?
Sure.
Yeah, so that is a really great question. And I think that we're seeing how that question is actually being answered through implementation now. We've kind of, I've noticed, because I pay attention in Seattle, especially after the summer of 2020, we've went more to decriminalization and consent-based services, and there's a less of utilization, at least in my experience, with services when they're not required. And I talked a little bit about this with my own story. So in 2012, prior to getting clean, I was arrested on December 5th of 2012. I relapsed in 2011, not because I wanted to, but because I felt like it was a better existence than the one I was living in. I was in a domestic violence relationship. I had been clean for a couple of years. Part of that was in prison. Once I started, I couldn't stop. I did not leave the relationship either. And I definitely was not going to give myself up to the police. Luckily for me, during that time, I had the opportunity to be arrested for the crimes that I was committing. But again, if in fact those policies that are in place now were when I was using, I most likely would not be sitting here, and I would probably be dead based on the amount of drugs that I use. Because my addict, the addiction that exists inside of me is not who I am, but it is much bigger than me, especially when I put drugs in my body. And I touched on that a little bit in what I was saying initially, that we lose the option to choose as an addict when you put it in your body. And so that is why law enforcement, judicial system, criminal justice system intervention is very effective when you implement it appropriately.
And so I'll give a specific example. One program is Jericho, which is in San Mateo County. It's for people who have committed more serious crimes. And the way the program is, you are on lockdown for a certain period of time. Usually, I think the average program length is 2 years. But when the person goes there, it's instead of state prison. So it's a way to avoid incarceration. So instead of being in jail, you're in a communal living arrangement. You exercise every morning. When new people come in, the ones that have been there longer, kind of get assigned to them to teach them how the program works and what to do. People are assigned chores. They have structure. But the other, you know, really good benefit from it was that you also learn a trade. And so I think it was electrical. Basically carpenter trades. And, you know, I was looking at what they were making. In fact, in one of my cases, the public defender and I were both talking to the defendant and saying, you know, if you make it through this program, you'll be making more than we do as city employees, you know, with overtime. So those programs, there's almost no chance that I saw with the defendants that I was working with, where they would take that over nothing. Like, they weren't going to take that program, be separated from their friends, be separated from the lifestyle they were living, and put all of this work in. They just would never do it. It was only when something was hanging over their head that it was, okay, you've got a choice of get all this job training and all this opportunity or go to state prison. Which one do you want? without that, it was never going to happen. And I think that there needs to be a carrot and a stick. And currently, cases aren't being charged appropriately. So, you know, strikes aren't being charged. Enhancements aren't being charged. So someone commits a crime that they should be looking at 25 to life, and instead they're looking at a couple of years. And so they have no interest in going into treatment. When I was a prosecutor, I would have residential burglaries and serious crimes. They would plead right then in order to get out again because they're dope sick and they want to get out. So that was always their focus. They weren't making choices in their best interest because they wanted to go get high again. Knowing that, it's better to let them detox in custody and then, you know, start services there and then find appropriate services, places like Jericho, if that's appropriate, or other service providers like Health Right 360 in the community. And then again, allow that person to decide what services would work for them. So they actually have some decision making in that process. And then when they don't follow through, and if they do fail, then, you know, there's also some, they own it themselves. It was like, this was the program you helped develop. It isn't like they're just being told what to do and don't have any say in their life. It's actually empowering them to make those changes and kind of, you know, decide what their future is going to be. And I found that to be effective.
Thank you. Sort of a follow-up to that, and it's also a subject that came up. The question that came to us is, what should we ask of our Board of Supervisors? I'm going to make it a more general question. And Tom, you mentioned, you know, really the function of charging people, which is a district attorney function. It's a law enforcement function. I'm sure the police are very involved in terms of how much evidence they have and so forth. How do we ordinary citizens who the means at our disposal are, of course, voting, campaign contributions, and possibly appearing sometimes at government hearings, how can we discern and hold accountable our public servants who are responsible for the things you're discussing?
Well, I think one, you know, voters have to do the research. And, you know, if you go back and you look at some of the campaign statements of some people, like you could see what they were going to do. And then you can hold people account based on their record. And that's with all politicians, I think. The statements made regarding like harm reduction, charging drug dealers. If you have elected officials saying, well, the drug dealers are victims. If they are, I've seen no evidence of it. And I was in their cell phones, their social media. I knew who was dating who. I knew hundreds of their backgrounds and where they were living. I saw no evidence of them being involuntarily trafficked. But I hear that being said by elected officials, and I believe it's an excuse because they don't know how to deal with the problem. So instead of coming up with effective solutions and dealing with the drug dealing problem, they say, well, we can't because they're victims. So, you know, give me a pass for having done nothing. And, you know, when I talk about prosecuting dealers, and I think that there's a misconception, you know, we don't want to restart a war on drugs. Well, that's the war on drugs was against drug users. I see for the fentanyl overdoses, it's a consumer protection issue. If people go and buy cocaine and they think they're buying cocaine and instead they buy a lethal dose of fentanyl, which is happening far too often in our city, that is not restarting the war on drugs. That is protecting people that think they're buying one thing and being sold poison instead. You know, that I think is a totally different issue that needs to be addressed. But I think that the way that you hold people accountable is hold them to the things they said in the past and have them explain their position and why it is. You know, I'm very comfortable explaining the positions that I have and why. I've done it with Jenny, and she's actually changed my mind on a few things, which, you know, because I listen to her and she'll tell me when I'm wrong. And then I think about it, and then my position changes. And I do think that there's hope for some of the politicians in San Francisco that are willing to listen.
Thank you. Jenny?
Can I make
Yes.
So I can't necessarily speak to the question, but I did want to speak just to a portion of what Tom was talking about, which is essentially it's kind of tangential, but at the same time, it's not. because I think we have these narratives that are really being pushed in our society right now that say, well, we cannot hold people accountable that were victims. So I can tell you I was victimized for a large portion of my life in a number of different settings. That did not give me the green light to victimize others. And when we're talking about addiction and we're talking about, you know, even as a, as an addict, I definitely victimized my fair share of society. And just because things that happened to me did not make that okay. And it is very necessary for us to hold each other accountable, you know, whether it's us holding officials accountable or holding people that are in our society accountable. It's really necessary. And if we actually want to help people become their best selves, because I don't know about you, but I don't like walking over bodies. I don't like walking over human feces. I don't like watching people be victimized in traffic and feeling like if I look at the entire problem, it's just too big. So I just pretend it doesn't exist. I don't like that. I don't like my child not being able to go play at a park. I don't like telling her, no, you can't go downtown because it's not safe, not even in the daytime. So it's my job as a citizen in any city that I live in that is experiencing these problems to participate in the solution. And part of that is me, what I'm doing today, which is I speak up and I'm very honest about it, because when I was held accountable, I then learned how to show up and participate in society in a way that contributed back to it. So, and I think that's our job to do that.
Thank you. Ginny, one writer brought up a quote from our local newspaper. And let's see if I can find it here. Just one moment. Yeah, the quote is that the sight of drugs, paraphernalia, and sales can cue in addicted people pretty powerful physical and psychological effects and represents a risk for relapse. This suggests that addicts who are starting to take the steps towards transforming their lives for the better have some headwinds against them if they're in an environment where drugs are being circulated, offered, sold. How much social control, which is to say outside influence, do you think is a good idea to try to buffer those headwinds or segregate addicts who are trying to get better from what I'm going to call these temptations?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we actually call them triggers. So addicts, we typically call those triggers. And so I think that it's really necessary, at least for a period of time, to have an addict in a sterile environment where they're removed from the environment where they are going to be triggered. One of the common things that happens, at least when I was working in Seattle, is as a supervisor, and even though my job was to put people in housing, I managed a number of other items in people's lives. I essentially helped them to live and carry out their lives. And when somebody wanted to go to treatment, I would facilitate that process as best I could. Those were very lengthy processes, especially for somebody with state medical. However, one of the biggest problems is that if you can actually get somebody into treatment in a timely fashion and they're able to show up and attend the detox appointment and then transition on to the treatment facility, one of the biggest problems is then they're being released back into the same environment. And that's a danger zone. It's a danger zone. And so for me personally, and I always like to draw on my own personal experience, this last time I was incarcerated, I was incarcerated for 6 months and I attended a treatment program inside. And then I transitioned into a more sterile environment that was a treatment-based shelter program where I did not have drugs and drug paraphernalia around me. So it gave me the ability to focus on my recovery, to really focus on building the skills so that I could become more stable. And then as I learned to participate in a recovery community outside of that, it helped me to keep myself safe. So I think it's important to provide that kind of space for the addict that is trying to change their life.
And I can speak to it in my caseload. I know that was always a concern with the triggers that were going to cause people to relapse. And, you know, I certainly thought about it in all of my cases. Some of the examples I had, you know, I would try and work with the judge. In one case, it was Judge Moody. We had a chronic offender who Judge Moody very graciously agreed to keep. One of the problems is that we would work out deals where everyone would be on the same page. Then the judicial assignments would change. And then there'd be a new judge who had no idea what we were talking about. It was like, well, we're not going to do any of that anymore. And so that would have been a problem. So Judge Moody kept this one case. And one of the things that we agreed on is when that person picked up a new case and they were going to be released, they wouldn't just be put out on the sidewalk to try and walk back home through the Tenderloin, that we would arrange for case management to take her home, make sure she had food in the fridge, make sure she was at least given a chance to, you know, maybe be able to stay clean. And there was no judgment on it. It was just, and when I was told, well, it's not going to work, it's like, well, at least she knows we care because we're doing that little thing of making sure. And so when there were barriers to that, I went to the sheriff's person who was right down the hall and said, is there any way we can get a warm handoff? They were absolutely willing to do it and make sure. And then I went to citywide case management, and they were absolutely willing to work on not just that case, but other ones to try and make sure that their clients wouldn't have those issues. One of the other things that came out of meeting with citywide, they asked, but what happens when our clients have bench warrants? And then they have that stress of having, you know, never knowing when they're going to be arrested. I said, well, if you call me, I'll call the public defender. We'll get it added to calendar and get their warrant recalled. And they said, well, what if our client has drugs on them? Are you going to charge them with that? I'm like, well, how would they not have drugs on them? That's what the whole issue is. Like, we're not trying to make their lives harder. We're trying to make going into treatment and changing their life for the better easier. And so The idea of trying to jam them up for drug possession when they call to take care of their legal issues, I'm like, we would never do that. But the reason why I bring that up is that was the perception, is that That's what we would do. And that nothing was further from the truth. So, yeah, there are ways to deal with that, but it's difficult. But by keeping people in custody longer, and this is one of the things that Jenny and I have talked about, was by keeping them in longer, keeping them locked down for at least 30 days, and then helping them to develop those tools, knowing what they're going to face when they're back out again, I think that's the best chance of balancing keeping people in for longer and giving them the tools they need to succeed without, you know, being heavy-handed.
Thank you. One of the things that I've noticed among people that I'm going to say are concerned with our humanity is that first and foremost, our job is to keep each other alive if we can, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of what I'm going to call the honorable motivation between some ideas such as safe injection sites. I'm going to invite you both to speak to us a little bit about what I'm going to call the whole philosophy of harm reduction. How much of that is really something that's useful for us to approach? What's the maximum amount of that maybe that we should be injecting into our policies?
Do you want to talk about it first, Tom, or do you want me to?
Oh, no, go ahead.
So I am not a supporter of harm reduction policies or safe injection sites. I understand the intent behind them. However, in working for the largest nonprofit in Western Washington for more than 5 years, and every area I worked in supported the harm reduction policy. And what I can tell you is that in the few thousand people that I served in that setting, I saw two maybe get clean, and those two were directly in groups that I facilitated and designed. And I encouraged abstinence-based thinking, which was very counter to what I was told was appropriate. We do not like the outcome of drug use. We don't like the crimes. We don't like the victimizations. We don't like the results of what happens when we consent essentially to people participating with addiction in a very open way, or, you know, in any way whatsoever. Yet we're comfortable feeding the beast down at this other section, right? So we don't like this, but we're feeding it here. It's kind of like putting in, you know, disruption in the gas tank and then expecting no exhaust that's going to be lethal to come out the other end. And so it's very counterproductive. That is not to say that we don't need to take a really good look at, and Tom, he really set up a great example of this. Like, I want to be able to help you proceed beyond this experience. So no, I'm not going to prosecute you if you finally show up and I'm asking you to show up and you have drugs in your pocket. We're going to know that, of course, you're not going to just automatically get clean and sober and change your life in a moment's time. But we're also not going to say, well, you know, we have this expectation for you to, you know, grow past this experience, but we're going to go ahead and support you continuing on in this way. It's an oxymoron, essentially. It's like jumbo shrimp, right? Where we're saying we don't like this, we don't want this, but we're going to make it easy for you to do this. But hey, maybe you should consider not doing this. And I think we can take a look at like my experience with addiction, which is I didn't want to use, but once I started, I couldn't stop. And when I do use, that beast is so big that I have no control over who I am. I have now become that beast. And that is the problem with harm reduction and the safe injection sites. But I do get that there have been a tremendous amount of deaths. And I also get that a lot of people just don't know what to do with it. But we need to start separating people very intentionally and start to address it that way.
And so this is like the one area I think that Jenny and I, if we do differ on anything, it might be on this. But I have a different experience. And that was when, you know, one, I was trained in harm reduction when I was at the East Bay Community Law Center and all through school at Berkeley. And also at the Bay Area Legal Aid. But it was very different than what I'm hearing people describe it as now. I mean, when I had clients that were drug addicted, I didn't talk to them about it or intervene or judge them when they would show up high. I would just reschedule their appointment and then have them come back. And the reason for that was, is that if I were to, you know, judge them, this is someone I have no relationship with. I'm trying to help them. And then at the first meeting, I then judge them for their behavior. I'm never going to see them again. And that wasn't the point. The point was, is to try and get them help, not have them do what I tell them to do. You know, and I had one of my supervisors once when I was frustrated for a drug addicted client that didn't show up on time. And he's like, well, you know, who do you think you are? Like, why are you more important than them? And he really kind of put me in my place and was like, you know, you talk to them this way, you think you're better than they are, they're never going to see him again. And you think you're good at your job because you're not helping your client. And I was like, ah, you know, he's kind of got a good point. So from that, you know, that's one of the reasons why I have, you know, kind of a different perspective on it as far as providing legal services, which it's not for me to judge their behavior. It's to try and figure out, work with them to try and get it to stop. And if I come from that, judging them or telling them what to do, very likely I won't see them again. Whereas a family member or somebody with a closer relationship can do that and still have that relationship with them. And then, of course, it's the increased deaths. I mean, the way the Tenderloin is set up with SROs, where people can't have visitors in their rooms, if they're not out using on the street and they OD in their room, there's nobody to save them. The ODs that are happening in tents and in the alleys. That's the reason why I think a safe harm reduction, you know, model that is the old school harm reduction model, where you actually try and get people into services and don't allow them to harm others, but also try to keep people alive until they're in that place where they can accept help. But I absolutely understand where Jenny's coming from. I don't disagree with her on any of it. It's just that there's an added issue of, there's 1,300 people have died in the last 2 years, and I want to see that stop.
Okay. Just a couple more things before we go to questions. Can either of you, and I know, Tom, you mentioned a program called Jericho, right? And I'm going to, you sort of describe that as what I'm going to call a best practice. Can either of you name any specific public servants in the United States and Canada who you particularly admire for their approach towards this phenomenon? Somebody that we might be able to look up and study.
Jenny?
I mean, gosh, I can tell you that I know some founders of nonprofits. Some of them aren't nonprofits, that are utilizing a peer mentor model. They do not practice harm reduction. They do not support safe injection sites, but what they are doing is they are facilitating the growth of people beyond the need for services, people similar to myself, people who have been incarcerated, and they're running very effective programs. I haven't really engaged with them enough to know exactly what they're doing, but I, you know, in regards to the broad scope of people that we're probably all familiar with, I am not familiar with anybody that I really admire their approach.
Okay, yeah, I wish I could say there was, but I don't. There's nobody that I agree with 100%. There are some that I agree with more than others. There's some that I think that are just completely wrong and are, I don't know where they're coming from with some of the things that they say. But there's no one whose approach I said, well, this is exactly what we need to do. But again, it's I have a different experience. I mean, I worked on these issues, seeing what works with people for 25 years, and I kind of have an idea of what's worked for the population I was serving. And I want to try and recreate those successes. And, you know, when I talked to Jenny and she tells me what worked for her, I'm like, well, that's exactly what worked for the clients that I had. And it's very difficult when you're talking to a politician who starts talking about how, well, you know, homelessness is caused by the tech industry and, you know, the price of rents. And it's like, it's a drug issue. How is, I mean, where is that coming from? Or when they say things like drug dealers make less than minimum wage. And I'm like, no, they don't. I know exactly how much they make because I see their wire transfers back to their country of origin. So, you know, when we're not even starting from the same set, the same reality, it's very difficult to agree with what their positions are. But I can say there's some people that I know that are in politics that as I have these discussions with them, they come around. Back when I was a DA, the one who seemed to get it was Mandelman. And when his legislative aide called me about some of the stuff we were doing, they were the ones that he was the one that seemed interested and seemed to get it. But I don't know what his positions are. I just know that he reached out and seemed legitimately interested in dealing with the problem back in 2018, 2019.
Yeah, and, you know, on that vein, I actually have been working with a guy, even though he doesn't directly work in the area of addiction. His name is Clarence Carter. He's the commissioner for Department of Human Services currently in Tennessee, and him and I have been working together because his goal also is to help design a social safety net, you know, eventually change our social safety net so that we're actually pushing people up beyond the dependency of all of these different systems that we have in the nation. So he is definitely trying to tackle that, but you know, government bureaucracy is a real thing. So.
Okay. Just two more. This one you might be able to address relatively quickly. If an elected politician tells us that what's in the way is that we're not spending enough money. How true is that?
I think it's false. And I'll shut up in just a second, Tom, because I have been doing this work with Clarence Carter. He ran DHS for the nation under two different presidents. So just in services under the Department of Human Services, they filter out more than $1 trillion a year in 86 programs that are absolutely ineffective when it comes to creating stability as opposed to dependency. So I think that's getting the crock.
I was going to use profanity. So Jenny actually was. It's completely untrue. There is no reason to spend more money. There's an enormous amount of inefficiencies, particularly with prosecution. The justice system is not set up to address these issues. It just isn't. It's unwieldy. It's adversarial. It isn't made to do this. And so when you have collaborative courts, the attorneys and the judges need to kind of take a step back and let the service providers, professionals like Jenny, decide what the program should be. So I never interjected myself into what the alternative sentencing plan should be. That was decided by professionals that know how to do that. The question that I had to answer was, is what was the penalty going to be if they didn't follow through with it? And is that acceptable? And then my job was to reach out to the victims and say, hey, would you agree to this? And then try to get their buy-in, because, you know, I wasn't doing these things without the permission, and not only the permission, but often the, you know, encouragement of the victims who wanted this to happen. And when they didn't, I would have to talk to them and say, well, you know, look, my job is to protect public safety. I want people to be safe. You know, if this person goes to prison and they don't get services, I don't expect that they're going to be safer down the road. Mm-hmm. And they're going to be back in, you know, living essentially in my neighborhood. I live currently in Mid-Market in the Tenderloin right now. And so I want my neighborhood to be safer. I take these issues very personally as far as in that regard. And so the idea that we need to spend more money or have more services, I disagree wholeheartedly. I think that it's absolutely fixable. One of the issues, I'll say this really quickly, I worked on a graffiti abatement issue. It was one police officer, one DA. We indicted a few taggers, and we brought graffiti abatement down by $10 million. So that was one cop, one DA. We saved the city well over $10 million. That's just the city. Private businesses was at least as much as that. And, you know, that was just an innovative new way of thinking about addressing the problem, not doing things the old way. And the reason why I did graffiti was that I wasn't allowed to go after the narcotics, which is what I wanted to do. So I changed that narcotics operation into a graffiti abatement operation. We prosecuted it differently. We chose our targets by going after who was the most prolific. And it had a huge effect and saved the city a lot of money. So, no, we don't need to spend more. We just need to be more effective.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I love hearing an answer that's so definitive. Okay, last toss-up here. I'm gonna request both of you offer us what you consider to be the three myths about this phenomenon that, in your view, you would most like to see corrected in people's thinking and perceptions.
Well, I guess I'll go. First is that that it's a problem, mental illness. Not to say that mental illness isn't a part of what's going on, but drug use symptoms are often misdiagnosed, and then you end up with this whole other problem. The next one is that people that are on the streets cannot make it out and live a life worth living, especially the ones that you think are completely out of their mind and will never change. And three, that we would have to completely revamp our system. I don't think that's correct. I think that we can take what we have and just adjust some things, be more efficient and more effective by using people with lived experience to actually create those programs.
Well, thank you. I agree with everything Jenny just said, so I'm only going to give you two more. So my first one is, I agree with everything Jenny just said. I think the other biggest myth is that dealers are somehow victims. They're not. They're profiting by millions of dollars a month, millions of dollars a month in narcotic sales. And the people that are buying those narcotics are funding that through auto burglaries and organized retail crime. So when you look at how out of control the theft is in the city, why Walgreens and CVS is closing, it's because the boosters aren't being prosecuted. They're doing it more and more. The fences aren't being intervened in. One of the other things, other assignments I had, I was on the Organized Retail Crime Task Force, which was created by Governor Brown, then renewed by Governor Newsom. So I was dealing with organized retail crime. And one of the myths is like, well, people are stealing to feed their families. It's like, no, the people that are stealing food, we had no interest in. There are people that are stealing, you know, $750,000 worth of product a year, one person stealing that much. And they're using it out of greed, and it's all going to the narcotics trade. So that's one of the biggest myths. Mm-hmm. And then the other myth that I'm constantly running up against is that people think that intervening in a drug user's criminal behavior is somehow restarting the war on drugs. And nothing can be further from the truth. Intervening in someone who is hurting themselves, their family, their kids, and hurting strangers as well, intervening and saying that is not acceptable is in no means a restart of the war on drugs. And also, prosecution doesn't mean incarceration. Incarceration can be a last resort, you know, and even charging cases appropriately and having that specter of incarceration hanging over their head is often something, and I've had this happen numerous times, where once they're looking at serious penalties, that motivates them to try and earn their way into another reality. And sometimes I don't even think they're sincere about it. It's like, well, I'm going to go through the motions and see if I can fool this guy. And then by the time they're doing it for a while, they actually start doing pretty well. So I don't know that it's always even coming from a legitimate place. I don't care what their motivation is as long as they're doing the work.
Yeah, I have to agree with everything that Tom said. Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much. I'm going to turn it over to Dennis. I believe he has a few questions that he's received from the audience.
I have a couple.
Thanks, Dean.
I have one statement and one question here in the chat. And after that, if anybody has another question, you can raise your hand and maybe you can address it directly. We have first person that says, yes, she, being Jeannie, would love to have you speak to the Board of Supervisors, judges and drug court and the DAs. Here's another question. So many news reports indicate that there aren't sufficient treatment options to the people in need. Is treatment scarcity an issue in San Francisco?
No, I'll answer this one because I'm very familiar with it. No, it's not. There were times when it would take longer to get a bed, and so there'd be inpatients. But I'll tell you, the defendants that I had that were the most successful, they weren't inpatient to get out. There were services in custody. So they were programming, and by programming, I mean engaging in, you know, drug treatment, counseling, going to groups, and doing all of that programming, and then working on a transition once a bed was available. So when people are impatient and want to get out right away, especially when they're drug addicted, I saw that as a huge red flag. So while they're impatient, I think waiting for a week or two for the bed to become available is not the end of the world. And since they're already programming, they're already doing the same work they're going to be doing when they get out. So I would always question why they would say, well, if it's not available now, I'm not going to do it. So just let me out. And I would have judges that would release people, and then they would immediately relapse, and they would never go into individual treatment. So, yeah, that I think is a real problem. But no, there's scarcity of services, and then there's people being sent to inappropriate services and that are being given services that are inappropriate for them. They have no intention of ever following through with. Drug dealers going to drug court, for example. So if we stop the people who don't need those services from using them, that opens up the door for all of the other people who could actually benefit from them, I mean.
Those are the only questions we have in chat. Are there any people there in the audience that would like to raise their hand and ask a question directly? You can either raise it on camera or use the Zoom, raise your hand. Well, I'm not so, oh, wait a minute. Frank, you have a question.
See if I can unmute myself here. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Great. So I'd like to know a little bit about the demographics of people on the street. You can speak to Seattle. Tom can speak to San Francisco. Are these all people, who come from low incomes? You know, they're people whose families have been poor and they're poor, or do you see middle class or even upper middle class people who sometimes have children or siblings who fall into drug habits and end up on the streets?
It is a wide variety of people. I have served people. I've used with attorneys that have ended up homeless. But I, even when I was in a service provider position, from college professors down to extremely low poverty stricken folks. It's just a wide variety. Addiction doesn't really discriminate. And you'd be surprised the different people that you find on the streets.
Yeah, I could say in my caseload, I had, you know, one gentleman who was breaking into houses, did multiple residential burglaries, and he was actually had previously owned a construction company in Chicago and came to San Francisco, kept coming out here because he would come out here and use and binge, and then finally just stayed out here. His company's marriage fell apart, and he was homeless and drug addicted in San Francisco. I had another person who, same thing, came out here from Utah, and was partying and just wound up getting addicted and out here. He was able to get into recovery. Amazing transformation. 2 years after he was arrested for robbery, he actually went back to Utah and got services there, but he also had the support of his family, and he was almost unrecognizable in how healthy and how much he had transformed his life. The other interesting thing about that was I was able to go back and saw his social media. So I was able to see he deleted the pictures of what he looked like when he was sick, but he still posted things about his family and all the help that he was getting and how thankful he was over those 2 years, which was, kind of heartwarming. I've seen college students and their families are trying to locate them, and they're picking up cases here in San Francisco. They come to court to advocate for them to get into rehab, and they have that support, and they just keep relapsing. So, yeah, it's a very – there is no particular demographic that is immune to that problem.
Thank you.
You had your hand raised. Take that one first, and then we'll go back to another one in the chat room.
What part of this data can be used to basically help the recall campaign, Bowdoin? All of the data that basically is, that I'm hearing here explains a lot of things. The property crime, the auto break-ins, the shopping, theft sprees. And meanwhile, what I'm reading in, San Francisco Press is how Bowdoin says angry elites want him out, or is he the most radical, DA in the nation? This is all just basically fluff, in terms of what's happening in the city, in terms of the real problems. I know that Tom was one of the people dismissed by Bowdoin, and I would want to know what can be contributed in terms of this very literate approach to the problem so that the press and the public could be more educated instead of, this kind of circus that we're having now in the press about whether to, who's at fault. And I know that Bowdoin's not the only one at fault, but he's certainly making the problem worse.
I can speak to it. I don't really have anything to say about him personally. I can say, though, everyone who's heard me here tonight, can kind of see where I'm coming from, because I'm always willing to talk to anybody. But, there's articles, since I've been outspoken about the DA's position on things, they call me a Republican. They bring up cases that I was never even assigned. They say that I tried to get life in prison on some case that I didn't even put the trial in. I never made an offer like that on it. So there's a lot of disinformation and just kind of, it's kind of silly to call Democrats Republicans in order to, undermine what's trying to happen. And I'm a lifelong Democrat. I've always considered myself a progressive Democrat. And by progressive, I mean trying to find new innovative ways of doing things. I always considered that to be progressive. I considered when you're prosecuting someone to try and avoid incarceration and find solutions that work to be progressive. And, I'm getting pushback now saying that, well, no, you're actually a alt-right Republican, which is just absurd. And I think with the data issue, though, that's different. With the data, the San Francisco police release all their data. The Chicago DA, they release everything. The SFDA does not. And I know that they just started releasing data after Stop Crime SF was going to bring a lawsuit forcing them to release some of their crime data. I was in the crime strategies unit. I knew exactly how far off that data was. So I'll give you one quick example. when I was assigned to go to the Central District to meet with the Union Square bid, which was the Business Improvement District, I pulled all the data from shoplifting because I was going to be meeting with retailers. I'd never met with them before. Our data at the DA's office showed that crime had dropped by about 15-20%. But then I talked to the retailers who told me that their crime had actually gone up by 475%, that our data was completely off. They had just stopped reporting because nobody was doing anything. And out of those discussions, the state task force came. And when you hear somebody say, for example, organized retail crime isn't happening, that Walgreens is not closing because of theft, but none of that is true, well, then why is there a state task force? How did that state task force just recover $8 million worth of stolen property if it's not happening? And so that's my frustration, is that the data is not being released. I think that all crime stats should be released. That data belongs to the public. It doesn't belong to public officials to decide what to release. I think the way SFPD does it is correct. They release all of the data by address, and you could know exactly what is happening at that location instead of cherry picking little bits of data to release and then spin it. So once everything's out there, I think that's always good. The other thing, and I would say this with, like, let's say fentanyl overdoses, you can talk about how many arrests you're making and, you know, quote unquote prosecutions you're engaging in. If the deaths are increasing, you're failing, full stop. And that was the model that we looked at with organized retail crime. We didn't look at how many people were prosecuting and then say, well, we're doing more than we did before, so therefore we're winning. The measure of success was, are the retailers losing money? If they're losing more money, we are failing. We need to figure out a new way to do it. And I think that is one of the things that needs to change, especially with fentanyl overdoses. If overdoses are increasing, we're failing, we need to do something differently. And I think that hasn't even been considered to this point.
Ginny, do you have a comment on that?
Sure don't. I mean, if you want data, I say take this qualitative data. When you hear the stuff that's contradicting what you see not working in the community, you know, and just like use that. But yeah, nothing quantitative. I don't know anything about the data there.
Okay. I got a message in the chat and we'll go to Eric after that. The question is, what steps would they advise ordinary citizens to take beyond the research that Tom cited?
Call things in. So one of the things I did when I was a DA was I would have, and I worked, you know, in the community. So I was assigned to the Tenderloin and Southern Police Districts. And I would go into the community meetings. People would tell me what they're experiencing. I would then take it back to the office and try and get permission to work on it. Well, if it wasn't a priority, I was kind of, you know, I wasn't in charge. So I did, you know, the assignments I was allowed to work on. But what I would do is tell them, look, email the board of supervisors, the mayor, the, you know, everyone that you can, and, you know, wait a day or two when no one writes you back, forward that email showing the first one you sent and everyone you sent it to, forward it to all the same recipients again, and every couple of days, keep writing and don't give up. Just keep bringing that to their attention. Keep reporting it, keep complaining. Well, after 3 or 4 weeks, that whole email chain mess would get sent to me and they'd say, hey, go deal with this. And I was like, hey, it worked. You know, the squeaky wheel gets the grease. And so if you keep complaining and you keep asking, it may be frustrating, but it'll open up resources and you might get, you know, hooked up with someone that actually wants to help. And I learned that from when I was doing government benefits work. I had a client that had a Social Security that was being terminated improperly. The case was a mess. We were getting ready to go to hearing, and my client was like, well, I'm going to call Nancy Pelosi. And I was like, okay, yeah, good luck with that. Like, what can she do? She's a politician. She's not an attorney. She's not here to help you with this. I didn't think anything was going to happen. Well, then the Social Security Administration called me and said they got yelled at by Nancy Pelosi's office. So they went back and reviewed it, and they were dismissing and reinstating my client's benefits. So after that, I was changed. I'm like, hey, if you want to call a politician and see what they can do, you never know. But I do know, as far as with reporting crime, the DA's office when I was there, but certainly SFPD, they allocate resources based on where their data shows crime happening. Mm-hmm. If you're not reporting it, you're not going to get those services allocated to you. So, you know, report crime, keep reporting it, keep letting the city officials know what's going on, and that email chain thing of just not letting up, that was effective when I was at the DA's office. And my old boss probably wouldn't be happy to know I was telling people to complain, but it was effective.
I'll just agree with Tom. Eric Brizzi, you have your hand raised.
Yeah, hi. Fascinating conversation, and I'd be interested to see if this turns out to be a bookend to early conversations in early 1990s. I worked for Community Substance Use Services here in San Francisco, attached to the Board of Supervisors. They monitor the contracts of the substance abuse services that are contracted out to the private not-for-profit that manage the recovery houses. In the early 90s and pre-medical marijuana even, harm reduction started to be a conversation. And I had a lot of questions about it then because I buy the abstinence model, and I think that I have seen that work. I have not seen harm reduction work. I'll be interested to see if there's an opposition view of harm reduction here that I haven't heard yet this evening. I wrote to Jenny very early. I like these conversations and agree wholeheartedly with Jenny. And I hardly ever hear this spoken, and I've gotten into many arguments about this. Bringing this, I see the chat, go talk to the Board of Supervisors, Jimmy. Go in front of the Board. I'm not so sure legislation is an avenue that is going to be successful to get this kind of thing moving. It's education. It's these kind of conversations that go through the real impacts, what I have believe are the real impacts of harm reduction, which the terminology that I use lately is that San Francisco, I believe, is held hostage by harm reduction, that we're not able to move the ball down the court because people are afraid of stepping on someone's, fragile rights. I just totally agree that the addict has lost that ability to make those decisions, and until they move out of that, are not going to make those good decisions. So I really just wanted to say here that I'm so encouraged to hear this conversation. Hope that maybe we can find other venues to make this the zeitgeist instead of, like I said, being held hostage, especially in terms of funding. Funding just moved over there totally. And I'm not so sure that the places that are really about the abstinence model are getting the kind of support that they should, simply because of the political mentality around this.
That's right.
I think if I was at the Board of Supervisors talking about, I don't agree with harm reduction, audience, people from the community, they would shut you down. And I'm encouraged by this. I'm wondering where it's going to go yet. I will just put in a little plug that we have a meeting that is starting up again. We call it the 1100 Block. It's at the Strand Theater on Market Street. And it has been a really interesting combination of people from the city government, from businesses in the neighborhood, not-for-profits, residents. And we met prior to the pandemic monthly. And the initial push on that was to, talk about what's happening in mid-market, which is such an emblem for what's happening everywhere. It was impossible for I work for American Conservatory Theater. That's why we're on the Strand. It was impossible for our patrons to feel comfortable coming to the theater. So they did not. That's right there. You're eviscerating the community by places that try to come in, and we're not getting the people to come back, because once they're there, they see the conditions that I believe harm reduction exacerbates. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Jenny. Very, very great to hear you talk about it.
Thank you, Eric. And I agree with you. A lot of the narratives begin academically, and if they're academic in nature, those are what's pushed into our society, specifically in our social service structure, because it trickles down directly, because we have a lot of those young students that are going directly into those jobs. And it's become the buzzword for funding. You're absolutely right there as well. Abstinence-based programs are challenged in funding, reentry programs and things like that. And so often they have to hustle really, really hard and find private donors that will actually support that, because it's the thing that's happening around the nation. Even though we can actually stop and take a look around, do a 360 in the middle of your downtown, and you can answer the question, is, are these policies really working? Because they're not. So thank you so much for your comments, and I agree with you wholeheartedly.
So I just like to say a couple of things. One is, Eric, I used to come to your 1100 block meeting when I was a DA, and that was fantastic. So anyone who's interested in these issues, if Eric is starting that meeting again, I would highly encourage you to go, especially if you're in the mid-market area. I live right down the street now, so I'm absolutely interested in coming. And then the other issue with the abstinence part, so when, you know, when the person is involved in the criminal justice system, they do not get a pass to continue to get high while they're doing alternative sentencing. Mm. You know, sobriety is part of that requirement. And this is the frustrating part, though, is that, you know, I also did nightclub security for years. You can't see because I'm sitting down, but I'm 6'6 and 300 pounds, and I was a bouncer for 1015 Folsom, which is the largest nightclub in the city. Well, I wasn't a bouncer. I was the head of security there. And, you know, so I dealt with, you know, people overdosing from party drugs and, you know, was very adept at being able to spot that when it was happening. And, you know, I'd have defendants come in who are clearly high and their judge doesn't recognize it and is telling them how great they're doing. And then afterwards, I'd be like, you know, they're almost chewing their tongue off. Like, they're clearly not sober, and telling them how great they're doing isn't helping anything. And so I think that there needs to be more recognition of when people are relapsing and what they're doing. And then the other issue that I would have is when people would be in an alternative program, if they haven't picked up a case yet, that doesn't mean they're not reoffending. And so if, for example, the person was a retail theft person and they were engaging in boosting, I would check with the retailers directly and say, do you have any cases with this person that maybe haven't been reported yet? And then I would get those and then go to court and say, hey, I know this person's committing crime in other jurisdictions, and call them out on it. And then I listen to the jail calls later and, you know, hear what their impression was of the fact that they were actually being held accountable. And it was effective. They would say, like, you know, for example, there was a quote from one person who said San Francisco used to be hell lenient, and now it's all messed up, and telling other people not to come to San Francisco to commit theft and to hit other locations. So I think these things are fixable. I agree with everything that Eric said. And again, that 1100 block meeting was fantastic for learning about what's going on in the neighborhood and trying to come up with solutions.
Eric has put the address, if anybody's interested, in the chat. It's April 4th, 10 a.m., Strand Theater, 1127 Market. Correct, Eric?
Yes.
One other question in the chat, if there's no other hands raised, Nathan wanted to expand a bit on his question, and we'll go with that. And unless there are no other questions, we'll try to close it up.
Yes, I appreciated everything that Denny and Tom said. I'm just asking if there's any way to, again, contribute to the campaign against Chase Abodin. Using some of the information we've heard now, I'm not really hearing people tying in retail theft and, you know, and auto burglaries to fentanyl addiction. It makes a lot of sense to me now. Given that you have the data, wouldn't it be, how can we hold our press accountable? How can we get that story out there? Because, again, we're hearing things like, oh, the public is, you know, has more, the perception is that there's more crime, right? They're always trying to kind of politely say, well, whether it's true or not, people perceive crime to have, you know, increased, rather than really use statistics and data. How can we give some literate voices such as yours to that campaign, in that case, in the media and in the statements of the Recall Chase Abodin campaign?
Well, I think one of the ways to do it is on social media. There's Twitter, there's Nextdoor, Facebook, all of those groups. There's it seems to be a very coordinated effort to put out disinformation about, you know, explaining away failures, not just from Chase Boudin, but also elected officials, where they'll make up excuses. They'll say things that are just absolutely false. And things like, you know, drug dealers don't make any money, where, you know, calling people out and saying, what is your basis for that? Where's your source of information? Because I would tell people, and I've done this online before, where they'll say something like drug dealers don't make money. And I said, okay, well, I've been in their cell phones and I've seen the wire transfers. I know how much money they're being arrested with. And I knew when their house or their apartment over in the Fruitvale district got hit, how much cash was lying around the apartment. Mm-hmm. So everything you're saying is contrary to all the evidence I've seen. The other thing is how many human trafficking reports have been made? Zero. There's only been two human trafficking investigations done by SFPD, and neither one of them went anywhere. When I had cases and the defense would say, well, my fentanyl dealing or, you know, heroin dealing client is, you know, being trafficked, I would say, okay, well, then let's put them on a GPS device so we can monitor where they are at all times. And in that way, they can't be used because wherever they go, law enforcement will know where they are. And I, you know, the judge said that was a fantastic idea. And the defense said they wanted no part of that. It's like, no, they're being trafficked. So you have to let them continue to be trafficked. So I think calling that out, because it's an absurd position. You know, the current DA says that the fentanyl dealers and the heroin dealers are all being trafficked and forced to do it illegally. If that's true, that means that there's 500 approximately people that have been kidnapped, forced to come to this country, and are being forced against their will to sell poison that is killing people. And the top law enforcement person has done nothing about it. So fortunately, it's not true. But if it was, then it's far worse than just doing nothing, because you're actually allowing people to be victimized. But it's an excuse to not deal with the problem. So calling that out on social media, I think, is effective. And then the people that kind of repeat those same talking points, oh, crime is actually down. Well, you know, no, it's not. And you're telling people, well, don't believe what you see. Don't believe what you see when you walk out the door. Believe the numbers I'm giving you. And that's just absurd. So I think that's the best way to do it, is when you see it and you see people talking about it, counter it and call it out for what it is. And ask them to support their position. When you say something like, well, all the dealers are victims, what are you basing that on? And when they say, well, you know, Matt Haney told me. It's like, well, you know, I've heard Matt Haney say that, and he never had access to the files that I did, so I don't know where he came up with it. So, and nothing against Matt. It's just not something that he knows about.
So would you be willing to lend your voice and your expertise to, you know, give that testimony to the campaign, quoted if possible, or is that, or do you not find that ethical as a...
Oh, no, I have been. So I did. I'm not connected with the recall at all. I didn't give them money. I actually didn't sign it. I do support. I do believe that he's a danger to the city. And so even though I didn't sign the recall, I have gone to recall events and kind of explained to people these things, because I do think that, you know, people are being harmed by it. But, you know, it's not anything other than that. I think it's just, I want the city to do better. And I think we can do much, much better than the way we're handling things now. So, yes, I have agreed, and I've talked at events, I've talked at fundraisers, and anybody that wants to know, I've always answered their questions. I've been contacted by the press a few times, and I'm always willing to give them information. And I don't ask where they're coming from or what magazine or what newspaper they write for. I'll talk to anybody. I don't pick and choose. I don't inject my politics into it. If they want information, I'm happy to give it. And I've been criticized for saying, well, you're only saying this because Boudin fired you. And it's like, I got hired by the Department of Justice almost immediately. You know, I wouldn't want to work for him. You know, and so I don't see that as, it's not vindictive that I'm trying to call these things out. It's just nobody else is in the position that I am to talk about it, because they haven't done the work that I did. They didn't have a backstage pass to everything at the DA's office. So I don't know who else would speak to these things. And I feel an obligation to talk about the things that I know, because I want people to do better.
I think we'd wrap it up. Tom and Ginny, unless you have a closing statement, thank everyone and we'll close up.
I just want to say thank you to everyone, and thank you, Jenny, for doing this.
Thank, Yep. Thank you so much for asking me, Tom. And thank you guys for having me.
You guys did a wonderful job.
Thank you very much.
So thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you. Have a good night, everybody.
Bye, everyone. Night. Thank you.